Thank you very much, Venerable Rabina, for being here.
Okay, good, fantastic. Just have to find the book. Can't find the book. Oh, fine. Well, then we don't worry about the book. Okay, so good. We're really here again. So we're thinking in final session, we're together. Listen, think about, analyze, contemplate, internalize these ideas, these views from the Buddha, so we can apply them in our life for our benefit. And then to also so we can benefit others, the mice, the ants, the mummy, the baby, the grandma, whoever. So we can help them continue to, like a miracle, get another human birth at least, so they can keep on, you know, keep on developing virtue and becoming a Buddha. Okay, good. So I think we should have more questions from left over from last time. What questions are there?
Okay, so does anybody have questions? If you'd like to raise your blue hand or put it in the chat for Rabina. David, would you like to unmute yourself and...
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, David.
Venerable, I'm 73. I've spent the last 30 years failing to practice.
Well done, David. It sounds like the rest of us.
I suspect I'm not alone in that. But
that's right, exactly.
Can you offer me the priority? What practices should I prioritize now?
Yeah, exactly. Taking refuge, keeping your refuge commitments, living in the five lay vows and purification every day, plus adding in a little bit of the Buddha, saying a few mantras and trying to be a nice person throughout the life. That is the most amazing, most powerful basis for a perfect practice. You can then guarantee that when you die, you'll at least get another human rebirth and you'll meet the Buddha and you will have good qualities and you'll have good conditions and you'll be able to keep moving on your spiritual path. Anything on top of that is a bonus. That's it. Take refuge, renew your refuge, renew your five lay vows and do purification practice every day. And well, I'll lead that practice before we finish. If you do just that, you're already bringing the Buddha into it. You're living a good life and you're purifying the past tendencies and you're creating the cause by not killing and not stealing and not lying, living in vows, that this will guarantee you a really excellent, perfect human rebirth.
Thank you.
Anything else on top is a bonus. Bodhisattva vows, anything else on top of that is a bonus. And that can be even more profound. But this is the absolute basis of a good practice. Is that clear, David?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, darling. Good.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you.
Yeah.
Kath, would you like to unmute yourself and ask a question? Thank you.
Yeah,
very confused about blue flags and hands and whatever. But anyway, that's beside the point.
Mine are all yellow.
Anyway, what about when people get stuck after they've died?
I don't know what you mean by stuck.
Well, it seemed to happen with my father, and there were a couple of people who kind of know about this, you know, and it was like he was so attached to where he lived. It was like he didn't go. It was like as though he couldn't move on. That was the impression.
That's not the Buddhist interpretation, Kath. That's more like the spiritualist interpretation. If it is true that your father is in your house, that means he's born as a spirit. It's a rebirth, and not a happy rebirth. If that's true.
Yeah.
If that's true, John.
Okay. So it's kind of like, which realm is that then when that happens?
The spirit realm.
Yeah.
You've got the animals, the spirits, which are the ghosts and all kinds, and you've got the hell realm. That's it. So if it really is true, though, I mean, are people see him around the house, do they?
Well, no, not anymore, but for a while he was there for sure. It seemed.
He was born as a spirit, so he might still be in the spirit realm, but this is why you've got to do all these practices for him.
Yeah, okay. That's just what I wanted to double check. Yeah, I mean, it's quite a long time ago, so...
I understand. So who knows where he is now, you know?
Exactly.
We always need to do practices for our loved ones because we've got a karmic connection with them. So this has enabled us to be able to help them by doing certain practices, by doing these practices Rinpoche recommends, by, you know, like blessing his ashes and this kind of thing. This could be beneficial.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Good darling. What else, people?
Thanks, Kath. Does anybody else have a question for Venerable Rabina? if you can't raise your blue hand, just wave at me. Amanda.
Yes, thank Amanda. You.
Would you like to unmute yourself?
Hi, Venerable Bijan. Lovely to see you again.
Good, yes.
So I work in... so I've been interested in death and little girls for all my life. I felt
your
the warmth with
death. Sound is a little, your sound is a bit blurry.
Oh,
a bit closer to the mic or something, I don't know.
It is a problem sometimes. Is that any better?
I think possibly, yeah. Go on, talk to me.
Okay, so I've been interested in death all my life from being very young and feel that we walk with death. My job entailed meeting death as a midwife. And now as retired, I'm working as a volunteer at the hospital.
Wonderful.
In the end-of-life death team. Not during the COVID time, but I intend to go back, and I also intend to haven't yet joined the volunteer chaplaincy as well. Mm-hmm. So what I do so far when I'm with people...
I missed that last phrase. What?
Okay, so what I can do when I'm with people so far is advise the relatives to talk about all the good things that the person's done in their lifetime.
Exactly.
And to keep the atmosphere sort of peaceful and cheerful.
Exactly.
If there's a television in the room, I'll try and turn it down as much as I can, try and work out how to turn it off or down. Mm. If I can, as I'm leaving them, I've been touching the top of people's heads. Mm. Is there anything else I can do, do you think? In that role.
Exactly, Amanda. This is the point. I mean, Rinpoche's book, you know, is full of advice, thousands of different things you can do. But, you know, you knowing your role, knowing what power or authority you have in relation to these different people, you select. So, you know, if you might know one person who's got no family and they're dying quietly and you talk, you know, do you meet the people? You go to their beds and you meet them. You have contact with them.
Hold their hand.
Okay, so then you can, the one thing you can absolutely do, you have to know their mind. So let's say one of the people loves God. So you can talk about God to this person. You can talk about heaven. You can talk about how God loves you. God is everything. And that'll make their mind so happy and they can relax and look forward to going to heaven. That's something you can do. Now, if somebody else doesn't have much a particular view, but you know, maybe some mantras while you're in the room, you can just be humming a mantra, singing a mantra, you know, Om Mani. It's a sweet sound that will bless their mind. So all the tools are in that book, but you can select according to what you feel you've got the ability and the power to do. Maybe one family, you know, they're totally dominating the whole thing and you can do nothing except be kind. But already being kind is the most precious thing. Looking them in the eye, you tell them what a wonderful person they are, what a wonderful life they have led. This is like nectar on earth, you know. So any of the things we've talked about, and if you've got the book, you select. There's all sorts of things, but you have to have the wisdom to know what's best at the time. The bottom line, like you've just said, is to make their room as peaceful as possible. Try and keep, you know, calm their minds down. Just the room being quiet calms down attachment, you know. The room being quiet calms their mind down. So when the mind is calm and peaceful, then the virtuous karmic seed can be triggered. And especially when the time of death happens. Are you ever there at the time when people go through this process and die?
It's possible that one is there when they die.
Right.
Or you might walk into the room and they've just died.
And then nobody as a family. So you mean the family offer's not there when they die?
Not always there, no. You can walk into a room and they're lying on their own.
Yes.
You know, there's this, you know, you kind of know when they're not there, really.
I understand. So this is where you, using your own wisdom, knowing the person, this is where you could just quietly sing a mantra. It's just a holy sound. It's not being naughty, like making them Buddhas. It's a holy sound. And that could be very beneficial for their mind. But the other thing, you know, Amanda, is you, if you can, to leave the body as long as possible before you get them to move the body. That's the most precious thing as well. And that's up to how much.
It's difficult in a hospital. You see, it's in a hospital that I volunteer, in the end of life care team. So it's mostly medical and nursing.
Are you there during the day or in the nighttime?
Day.
So let's say you walk in at 11 o'clock in the morning and there's no one else there. I mean, you can just sing a mantra and then you can leave the body alone, can't you? Until somebody else discovers it.
Yeah.
Do that. So in other words, have it in mind without causing problems that you leave the body as long as possible without disturbing. That's the thing you can. Again, you've got to use your wisdom, Amanda.
Yeah.
I think you can say a mantra, just sing a quiet mantra. This is such a powerful blessing for people's minds at that time. They're the things you can do. And then while they're still there, you can be kind and say good words. You know, even if they're in a coma, you can say a mantra. If they're half asleep, I mean, there's just, these are the things you can do to be a kind, calm presence for them. And then praising them and loving them and thanking them for being a good human being. This is like a miracle, you know.
I'd say things like, everything's okay. Everything's just as it should be. You mustn't worry about anything because everything's as it should be. Because I don't know what religion they are sometimes. Or if there's somebody there with them, then
But you don't even need to say don't worry. Just say wonderful, uplifting things. You're a wonderful person. Everything is perfect. Everything is good. You are so good. Say optimistic, positive, calming words, you know?
Yeah. Also, I thought I'd just bring this in. This is good thing. It's a death plan.
What do you mean, bring it in?
To show everybody. It's a death plan.
I know that, but what does it say inside?
It's got, there's a table of contents, and it's got things like, what is the document for,
but it depends on the person, darling. If they're sick and old, I mean, that already just would overwhelm them just by looking at those words. I mean, it's...
This is for Buddhists. It's a Buddhist death plan.
I believe you. I'm sure it's Buddhist, but I'm saying it already looks overwhelming. Just that 47 lines in the contents, and there's this poor person dying slowly. I mean, excuse me. I don't think I want to show them that. What are you saying then? I'm missing the point.
It's to show these people that are in your course that you can get this assessment.
Show which people. Who would you? I'm a bit confused now. Who would you show this pieces of paper to?
The Sangha that we're with today.
Oh, you're talking about us. You're not talking about bringing that into the people who are dying.
Not the people who are dying. All your students today.
But who created this document?
SPMT, Lama Zopa.
Well, I think you should design it better for a start. Get a nice graphic designer to make a little cute little book out of it. I can see that. Good. It's wonderful, absolutely. But it should be designed better. That's my first point. I love beautifully designed things. Is this A4 boring old typing? Who did it? You do type it? I'm being rude to you now.
No, Lee. You can get it on Lee's website, Lee's Jamyang.
Oh, in Leeds. Okay, I'm going to tell Kerry then to get it redesigned and make a beautiful book. Easy to read. God help me. Okay, very good idea. Thank you for that. Now I understand, Amanda. I imagine you bringing this into some old perky and happy, this long list of things for the poor dying person. You'll blow their mind. You know? Excuse me, I'm too tired. Go away. Okay, now I understand, Amanda. Thank you, darling. Wonderful. Okay, very kind. Good, darling. Perfect. You're doing beautiful. It's a wonderful, special job. You're doing so good. Okay, what else, people?
Thanks very much, Amanda. Anyone else with questions for Venerable Robina? Please just do the blue hand thing, or if you want to just, Yuval, okay? Yeah, do you want to unmute yourself, Yuval?
Talk to me, darling.
Yes, I had to find the unmute. Thank you so much, Venerable. I have a short question going back to the Yidam kind of practice or finding your Yidam.
Yeah.
And well, to explore it, first of all, is there a way to find out about all the specific qualities of the Yidams that so you can kind of like, you have to get familiar with it.
That's right, exactly. Well, you know, sort of just the way it's passed down in the lineage, you know, you sort of, you pick it up like anything. All this information, if you're a Buddhist in Tibet, you pick it up just by being around your family and the monasteries, you pick it up. So for us, it's fairly new. But I know that there are thousands of these Buddhas, and it's a bit overwhelming to start searching, like searching online for a girlfriend. You go crazy. So maybe it's more, you know, get the teachings, you read Lama Yeshe's book, for example. I think if you read Introduction to Tantra, if you read Lama's teachings, it gives you a feeling for it all, which is really beneficial. And then, of course, all the popular, the Buddhas, that in the different levels of Tantra, and the first level, you don't need to have an empowerment to be given permission to do the practice. Although, of course, you can receive the empowerment, which is excellent. So you start with the ones that are popular, Chenrezig, Tara, you know, Medicine Buddha, Manjushri. There's many, they're part of life. You just start to learn them. You do their little meditations. You can do their mantras. You know, that's really beneficial. And then you've got more advanced levels of those different Buddhas in the highest Tantra. And they're the ones you can learn about. So there's the popular ones, the main ones. There's probably half a dozen, you know. So there is a book published by Wisdom years ago, and I think it's still around, by Jonathan Landau and the artist Andy Weber. They collaborated on a book that mentions many of the main deities and describes their qualities. And I can't think what it's called, but it's published by Wisdom, and the author is Jonathan Landau, L-A-N-D-A-W, and the artist Andy Weber, W-E-B-E-R, a German artist based in the UK. So look up a book, something's got, in the word enlightenment is in the title. It was published years ago by Wisdom, and it's got a bunch of pictures and descriptions of all the main deities. So that could be a good start for you as well.
Thank you very much. Yes, can I add just one little question?
Yes, you've
asked. It's like, when would you know, like, you're to receive empowerments? I mean, it's already quite rare to come about. And then is it like, would you advise to, if you find an empowerment and you feel trust for the Lama,
I understand. So these days it's quite difficult because it's only on Zoom. There's no Lamas giving them in person. But the thing is, it's like, first of all, the prerequisites for taking an empowerment, for entering into Tantra, the prerequisites, as Tsongkhapa puts it, are really the sound practice of all the sutra teachings. First, renunciation, understanding, abiding by the laws of karma, understanding clearly what karma is, living in your vows, doing your purification, and then understanding your mind. That's the ground level of practice, which is the first two scopes, what I call junior school and high school. Understanding karma, abiding in the laws of karma, doing your purification. This is the ground, the basis of all practice. Then you get to the next level and you start to become your own therapist, as Lama Yeshe says, and you really learn to know your mind. This is the wisdom wing. This is the basis of a good practice. So then living in those vows, they're the vows, what they call the vows of individual liberation. They help you get liberated from samsara. That's the ground. And that the main realization that comes from practicing at these levels is called renunciation. You understand suffering and you understand its causes and you are fed up with suffering. That's the meaning of renunciation. You're really intimately familiar with karma and the delusions, you know, and you want to get the hell out of suffering. You're sick of it. So that's renunciation. That's the first prerequisite. The next one is having a reasonable ground, again, sound understanding of the next level of practice, which is bodhicitta. Really understanding that you're having studied the teachings in the Lam Rim, you know what bodhicitta is, you know what compassion is, and you're really attempting to practice it. And you have a really strong appreciation for bodhicitta. That's the next prerequisite. Now, the next one is at the most advanced levels in the sutra practices in the Lam Rim, where you now go to the next level of practice, where you practice the six perfections of the bodhisattva, where you now, the sixth one, is where you meditate on emptiness. So that's the third prerequisite. So at least having a grounded, informed understanding and a wish to practice renunciation, bodhicitta and emptiness. If you have this sincerely and understand where all the teachings fit, and you've got a solid practice and you're keeping your vows, you're keeping your commitments, then you are ready technically to enter into Tantra. So that's the first point. So then there are some practices, and you should start doing those, like Manjushri, Tara, Chen Raising, that you don't need to have an empowerment to do, although it's excellent to receive the empowerment. So, you know, these days the lamas are giving things on Zoom. This was never before that you were allowed to do anything on Rinpoche would never, ever give on internet. But now it's happening. His Holiness set the precedent. He's given already initiations, and they're sitting there in the, you know, on the website of His Holiness, so that you can receive initiation online now, you know. So I think it would be a marvelous opportunity to take it. I mean, I know one time, some people, you know, I led a group of people who took the initiation online from His Holiness, you know, where you take the bodhisattva's vows with him, and then you take the empowerment, say, for example, into Chen Raising. These are marvelous opportunities now, so special. And other lamas are giving highest yoga tantra initiations, some Gelugpa lamas as well. So you need to do your research and be very, very clear and very careful, because some lamas are not, you know, they mightn't be your tradition, they mightn't be valid. We can often get a bit excited and leap in too quickly, you know. So I'd suggest, because you and I have this relationship, so why don't you check up on these things? And if you see anything there, write to me and discuss it with me. But the thing is to be clear. So some people leap in very quickly. I mean, I have many examples of people who get all excited, done all the things, got the prerequisites, then read about some initiation. One person went into color chakra, which is very serious, and he leapt into it. And then he panicked halfway through and gave it up. He couldn't cope. He was a bit overexcited. So I think the thing is, keep practicing, keeping your lay vows, do these things, eventually take the bodhisattva vows, and eventually take these empowerments, and then it will grow organically. So then we pray every day that the situation arises where these lamas are going to be give them in public again, you know. But they are online, so it's so special. So check up His Holiness, and you can discuss it with me. Email me, and we can talk about it more if you'd like.
Thank you very much, Venerable. Thank you.
Thank you, Dominic.
Thank you. Thanks, Yuval. Thank you.
What else?
Anybody else with any questions for Venerable Robina? Blue hands, or wave at me, or just unmute.
Well, then why don't we do this? I promised I would lead the purification practice, which I think is, you know, as in one of the things that when David asked, I pointed out to David, this is, you know, let me just remind us again of the framework of all these practices, because we get overwhelmed sometimes. You know, as we know, this amazing packaging of the teachings that Tsongkhapa in the 14th century put together, which is similar to the packaging of the other Tibetan traditions, all of which are based on the teachings of Atisha, who, when he first came to Tibet in the 11th century, whatever it was, he wrote this little text. And what he did was take from the vast body of knowledge of Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist metaphysics, Buddhist psychology, all the rest, he took the main points of all of the Buddha's, this vast body of knowledge practiced in the, you know, going back to India, the great Nalanda tradition, which is very much the tradition that's now extant in the Tibetan monastic university system. His Holiness perpetually tells us about, we are now the Nalanda tradition. These great Mahayana scholars and saints, you know, the yogis, all the Vajrayana scholars and saints as well. So he took the teachings of Buddha, basically, and what Atisha did was he took the essence of this vast body of knowledge and presented the teaching from the experiential point of view. It's easy to get so caught up in these amazing philosophical teachings and get very, because we're so clever, we're so well educated in the West, we can get very captivated by all these theoretical ideas. But Atisha, what he got was he took these points and he presented them in a very orderly way, orderly, like any body of knowledge that you're trying to internalize, orderly from the point of view of the practitioner, sort of obvious, but especially though experiential. So the very first point, to the essence, as we know, and as Lama Zopa politely, respecting the lineage, politely calls the first level of practice in this packaging that Tsongkhapa calls the Lam Rim, gradual path. Rinpoche refers to it as the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the least capability. Well, it's a big mouthful. You know, I call it junior school. And it's kind of cliched, casual, but instantly we get it. Because you know you go to junior school before you go to high school. We know that. but teachings and practice are suitable for the disciple of the least capability. So this first level of practice, often they refer to as the teachings and practices, you know, according to the scope, the capacity of the student. So that the essence of this level of practice, and this is where I spoke to David, the essence of it, the culmination of the junior school practice, there's a series of things that a teacher gets us to think about, that, like we've talked, the first one is death and impermanence. Why? Because a teacher's trying to give us a wake-up call, not to waste his precious life. Then he gets us to think about the suffering of the lower realms. Why? Because now we realize we'll die at any moment, and the likely possibility of types of rebirth, according to Buddha's view, are many suffering ones. And hey, baby, we do not want suffering. So this increases the wake-up call, increases our sense of urgency not to waste this life. So then you think, well, whom can I turn to give me methods to not have this kind of suffering? So here we turn to the Buddha. He's like our doctor. So we take refuge. So then the next level, now we begin to practice. The culmination of the first scope, the culmination of junior school, the culmination of these practices and teachings suitable to the disciple of the least capability, the combination of it and the foundation of all future practice is the abiding by the laws of karma. This is where we really begin to practice. We're priming our minds by thinking about impermanence here. We're priming our minds by thinking about the lower realms and then taking refuge. And now we put our money where our mouth is. Now we start to practice. So when David asked me, what is the essence? This is the essence. You abide by the laws of karma, which is this natural law that runs the universe, such that everything we think and do and say programs our mind and turns us into the person that we will become. So the most powerful, the most potent, the most delicious way to abide by the laws of karma is to live in vows. The difference is incredible. Rinpoche stresses this, and this is Buddha's teaching. When we get this, we will be sad not to live in vows. Okay, so the bottom line is this. Every second of the day, whatever we think and do and say sows a seed in our mind. And we want, at the time of death, a bucket load of delicious, rich, intentional, non-killing, non-lying, non-stealing, non-harming karmic seeds. We want bucket loads of them because we want one of those to be triggered that will determine our next future human birth. So when we create karma, we mentioned this briefly. When we do an action, karma means action. And every millisecond of the day, we are doing actions. And there's various components in each of those actions that determines the character of the action we do, therefore determines the character of the seed we plant, and therefore determines the character of the future fruit. So we want the best seeds, the most delicious seeds. And the best seeds are those in an ordinary action of, let's say, not killing that mouse. There have to be four things in place when you do an action, in order for that action to become what they call a complete action. And a complete action is one that drops a karmic seed in your main bank vault, which was the one that will determine a future rebirth. The other three bank vaults are like residual results left over that then create the cause to have the tendency to keep doing that action, or have the action done to you, or have the environmental result. But the main one is the karmic seed that has four things in place when you do it, that will be the one that drops into your main bank vault. And that's the karmic seed of, let's say, especially non-killing, that you need to be triggered at the time you stop breathing so that you can ensure you get a nice another human mummy and you can keep on moving on your spiritual path. So now, if every millisecond of what we think and do and say drops a seed into our bank vaults, and we want the virtuous ones to be strong, so the very first level of practice is to refrain from killing, refrain from lying, refrain from stealing. As Lama Zopa says, the very first level of practice, immediately, this second, is don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, don't this, don't that. Now, the point is this. At this moment, we are sitting here absolutely not lying, because you're not even talking. But this is the point. You're not creating any virtuous karma of not lying, because the crucial piece, which is the intention to not lie, is missing. That's when you create karma. So the four things in place, like a simple action of non-killing, and non-killing is the most powerful virtuous action, at this level of morality, which is junior school and high school, which is the wisdom wing, and this is the Hinayana or the Theravadan level of practice, which is the foundation of the Mahayana, that this level of practice here is the morality of refraining from harming. It's called the morality of restraint. This is the first level of practice, you know. So, four things that need to be in place when you do an action called not killing. One, there has to be an object called a living being, like that mouse in your kitchen. Two, is your mind involved in it? And there are two things there. There's more to it, but this is the simplest way to put it. There has to be, two A is intention. Bare bones, I will not kill. 2B is the motivation that impels that intention. So mostly the motivation and the intention are so mixed together, we think they're the one thing. So let's say you kill a mouse. Let's say the action is called killing, not non-killing. So one, there is a mouse. 2, intention. I will kill the mouse. So instantaneously, it's because it's completely driven by your disgust for mice. How disgusting a mouse be in my kitchen. You don't think first, oh, I hate mouse. What shall I do? I think I'll kill it. They come together. Well, the same, practically the same here. If it's an action called non-killing, that there has to be the intention. This is the meaning of the word karma. The meaning, the actual meaning of the word karma is mental action, and that is intention. And that's in our mind every millisecond. It drives everything we do. But as I said before, 99% of what we do is driven by instinct, but they're intentions. But we don't notice. So here, there has to be the intention. It's a conscious thought. I will not kill the mouse. Now, what's your motivation? That's 2B. Well, it's compassion, isn't it? 3, you do the action. You pick up the mouse or whatever. And 4, the result of the action, a living mouse. You let the mouse out. Thank you very much for being a happy mouse. That's a complete action of non-killing. Now, how often do we meet mosquitoes, ants, cockroaches, you know, rats, mice, where we have to consciously say, I will not kill, because that's the only time you create a virtuous karma of non-killing, when you meet the creature and you consciously decide, I will not kill. And the strength of your compassion is the key factor that determines the strength of the virtuous karma. Now, how often do we do that? We're sitting here right now, we are not killing, fact, but we are creating zero karma of not killing. And we need our bank vault at the end of our life full of delicious, rich, rich, conscious, intentional karmic seeds of not killing. Now, how do we get ahead of the game? That's where vows come in. Buddha loves his vows. According to Tsongkhapa, I think, vows are a subtle physical form that are visible to clairvoyance. Vows are so potent. So what is a vow? Here we're talking about a Buddhist vow, which means, you know, Lama Zopa, for example, giving me permission to give vows when I give refuge, because you can't take vows until you've taken refuge. So the point is this, it's so powerful. I received these from my Lama. He got them from his Lama. He got them from his Lama. And you check this. You will track back in an unbroken chain of real humans, these vows in an unbroken chain right back to the Buddha. I think that's very tasty. Like you're plugging into this power source where you in front of somebody who is a Buddha for you and you vow, you repeat 3 times, I will never kill, I will never lie, I will never steal, et cetera, whatever it is. So that vow is so potent, Rinpoche says, and that's just quoting Buddha, that it's in your mind 24 hours a day. So if you don't have a vow not to kill, you only create the virtuous karma of not killing. And again, you need bucket loads of those at the time of your death. You only create the karma of not killing when you consciously meet the creature and decide not to kill. Whereas if you live in a vow not to kill, vows are so potent that they're in your mind stream continuously and 24 hours a day that you are keeping them. You are ticking over virtuous karmic seeds of non-killing. So you've got billions of strong karmic seeds in your bank vault. And not only that, but it's got the power, because vows are so powerful, it's purifying your habits to kill and putting atomic, you know, and preventing you from killing, ticking over virtuous karma 24 hours a day and putting atomic bombs under the past tendencies of killing. So we can't get ahead of the game without living in vows, Rinpoche would suggest. He says it's just not enough to be a good person. And why? It's because anyway, even if we do run around every day saving mice and not killing them, our motivation is not that strong. We're not bodhisattvas, so our compassion is quite weak. We're prepared to save one ant, but if suddenly you've got flooded in the whole house of 50 million ants, I'm sorry, our compassion's not strong enough to want to spend weeks saving every tiny ant. It's too much effort for us. So then with vows, they're so powerful that 24 hours a day you've got them in your mind stream, you're creating virtue. So it's like getting 1,000% return on your investment. And don't think I'm being crass. We need to think this way, because we're not great yoginis and yoginis. And that's why David's question was so perfect. What's the minimum? What's the best? You've got to select from all these practices. You know, many people think I've got to be mindful, so they sit there watching their breath for an hour every day. I mean, there's almost no virtue in that, because there's no bodhicitta. We're so obsessed with getting concentration. We're not that good meditators. There's no vows we're living in. There's almost nothing. You're sort of like you're going up one step and turning and dumping down 20. There's just not enough power in it. We have to be skillful, because we're not the greatest yogis. You're going to go to the mountains 24 hours a day. That's why David's question is so perfect. What exactly at the minimum? So this is the foundation of anything you build on top. You can watch your breath for 27 hours a day and you won't get far. You just keep a vow purely, purify every day, and think of the Buddha a few times. Incredible more powerful virtue and incredible more purification, because of the power of vows and the power of the holy beings, you know. It's such skillful means to know. It's such a perfect question that David asked. Perfect. And then you can relax. Then any other practice you want on top of that is a bonus. This is bare minimum. This will get you another human rebirth, bare minimum. You can do more. You can go to the bodhisattva path, get bodhicitta. You can realize emptiness. You can get out of samsara. You can ignore these. But the foundation is the morality of refraining from killing and stealing and lying and harming, purifying those habits, living in vows, and doing the purification practice, which we'll do in a minute. This is junior school, entry level, grade one practice, and powerful. Then you can go to the next level and get even more renunciation by understanding your mind, getting rid of delusions, giving up attachment. That's built upon this lot. That's the next level, high school, middle scope. So it's so important to understand the mechanics of karma. Not just vaguely, oh yeah, I like karmas, you know, blah, blah, blah. We talk this way. We say, oh, I believe in karma. What good is that? It's like saying I believe in botany. What good is that? I'm happy you believe in it. It works. You better know how it works to get the benefit from it. Just believing in karma, superstition. You've got to know how it works so you can apply the law in your life. This is a fundamental point, you know. Olya's got a question. Is it about karma, Olya?
Venerable, yes, it's just a quick, I got a bit confused. So when you say is it correct to think that if I reiterate the vows, that will help create the seed? Or is that necessarily need an object for me to create the seed? So I got a bit confused.
So maybe spell it out a little bit more, Olya. And I'm glad you're confused, because I know it's so important to be clear. So please ask the question, but in another way. I don't understand.
So when you say that the karmic seed is created only when we intentionally do not kill. So for example, when we see a mouse and we specifically do not kill her.
Yes. Because, yeah. And that's right, because when there's not the vow not to kill, it's only when the mind engages in something, that's the meaning of intention, I will not kill. Intention is the actual meaning of the word karma. It's mental action. Then you drop a seed in your mind. Because logically, if there's a mouse there, but you don't see it, there's no intention, there's no compassion, there is no thought, how can you say you've created karma? Mind creates karma. So mind has to engage in something. So if there's no mind engaging, you might even not kill, you know, you might step over the mouse, but you didn't even see it. Technically, you didn't kill a mouse, but there's no mind involved. So there's zero virtuous karma. That's okay. The point.
So my question then is, if I every morning reiterate my vows and
so there's assuming, just a second, Olya. So we're assuming that you've taken the Buddhist vows.
Exactly, yes.
So every morning, yes, you reiterate them. And yeah, then, that's right, absolutely. But the point also is, as I said, and you strengthen them every time, but the fact that you have the vow in your mind stream, 24 hours a day, you're keeping them. You are ticking over virtuous karmic seeds in your bank vault, even without motivation and without intention. Such is the power of vows. You don't just leave them there. You do reiterate them. You do remember them, and they guide you throughout your day. And then at the end of the day, which is what we're going to do now, you then purify, even add an extra component to your practice by doing the purification practice, which continues to put atomic bombs under your habits. And the crucial thing about the purification, well, I'll talk about that in a minute, but so far, yes, your point is correct. Are we clear?
Oh, okay, just to sort of, you know, the final sort of conclusion that I make. So if I'm taken, so since I've taken the vows and I reiterate them every day and I try to live by them every day.
That's right,
and
exactly.
Even though I don't meet the mouse, I still create karmic seeds in my
mind. That's the point. 24 hours a day. That's the point. Okay. That's Buddha's teaching, but Rinpoche stresses this. And when we can hear it technically, it's very delicious. It's very powerful. I mean, we want to get ahead of the game. We want to really practice. We want to create lots of virtuous karmic seeds, and we want to purify our tendencies. This is how we do it. Exactly, Olya. This is the point.
Perfect. Thank you so much,
Bernard. Okay, so now there's more to it than that as well. This is the point here now. This is the part that's very interesting. There are four ways that our actions ripen in the future. So the main one, they call it the fully ripened result, which is the result of a complete action, let's say of non-killing, is the one that gets us a rebirth. So the key cause of a human body, just getting a human body, is non-killing. So, but that's not enough. We look at the humans on this planet now with respect to the beloved humans. There are 7 billion of us, and people have got a human body. But now let's look at the other three ways our karma is ripening in this human life. Now, this is the tragedy. So a person, let's say I'll use the example. I also use the example of this one boy, this mother I met years ago in Copan, talked about her boy who was a professional fisherman. From the time he was tiny, he met fishing. He fell in love with fishing and he spent his life fishing. So now, using his as an example, he got a human body at the time of his past death. He could have been a dog, an ant, you name it, more likely to be of an animal. And he got a human body. He like won the lottery, although it's not the lottery. It's actually not good luck. It's because he had a virtuous karmic seed there, but he'd been in the lower realms in the result of killing. That karma eventually ran out. The petrol tank of negative karma ran out, and like a miracle, one of his virtuous karmic seeds was triggered, and he got a human mummy. So now he's born in California in this particular case. He got a human body. Now let's look at the next three ways that karma plays out within this life. And every being is the same. So you've got the next one is your tendencies, the intentions or the tendencies similar to the cause. That's your personality, your tendencies. So he, in fact, had a lot of good tendencies. Kind, he was generous, but he had a tendency to kill. So he met fishing. Soon as he was a little boy, he met fishing. Instantly, because of the strength of his past killing, okay, why did he have a tendency to kill? This is the first point. Why do some people, like another friend of mine, I always quote these two examples. He's a little boy, she's a Buddhist, and her son is now like 40-something. But when he was a little boy, like 2 or 3, she's taking the lice out of his head, and he is crying with compassion for the lice. Mommy, mommy, don't hurt them. It's their home. Leave them alone. He was having compassion for the lice. Now, in each case, those mummies did not teach their little sons, one, to go fishing. That mother couldn't stand fishing. And two, to have compassion for the lice. And this boy is now 40-something, and he's never wanted to kill a living being. So the crucial question is, what is the difference they've both got a human body, but then we look at the minds of each of those boys. One had a spontaneous wish not to harm, and in fact never killed. And another, even though he didn't kill his mummy or daddy, he wasn't a monster, but he had the tendency to kill fish. So he fell in love with fishing. This is the point now. What's the difference? That the boy who had no thought to kill and not even had compassion for the lice, he had lived in vows in the past. So the boy who'd been in the lower realms, he exhausted the killing karma, but he then and then got a human body, but he hadn't purified the tendency to kill, which is the second way karma ripens. The next way karma ripens is called the experiences similar to the cause. And in this case, due to past killing, he got that one as well. He died young and he was killed. He died scuba diving at the age of 29. So that's the karmic result of past killing called the experience similar to the cause. He had the first one, which is the tendency to kill from past killing because he hadn't purified it. This one is the tragedy. The next one, he even got the experience similar to the cause, which means he died young. He drowned scuba diving at the age of 29. And the third of these three results in this life is the environmental result. Now, he didn't have that one. That would be the result of killing would be the environment harms you. You get sick. You're always getting sick. The environment polluted. The water's polluted. The air's polluted. The food is bad quality. Now, look at the world, please. Look at the human planet. 7 billion humans. Most humans, I think, kill. Even most religions say it's okay to kill. I was taught as a Catholic that God made the creatures for our benefit. It's completely appropriate. And if you really, some people who really love God, they feel honored to go and kill the deer and kill the fish. I'm not being sarcastic, because you're doing God's will. That's a view in the world. Most humans kill something. Now, the scientific view, coming back to the Greeks and the Romans and the Catholics in Italy and all the Romans and the Catholic Church and the Christians, which say that, that animals don't have a soul, we've carried that on in the scientific view where we think creatures don't feel things. So we use animals. Look how we misuse animals, because they don't suffer, we say. Now there's a bit more awareness of animal suffering. So that's tendencies in our mind. So most humans spend their lives killing. Why? Because they haven't purified it by one, doing the purification, or more basic, by living in vows of morality. So that is the total tragedy. So this boy is a typical example, a good person. No one thought he was a monster because he went fishing. We love fishing in our culture. And I think it's because fish die quietly. I mean, if you all go, we get a bit nervous of going running around killing deer because they make a noise and they sound and they run away and they look scared. But fish die quietly. The poor things don't have legs. They have no voice. They just flap their bodies in the boat. And this is the tragedy too. The mother never wanted to go fishing, but she wanted to honor her boy, you know. So she went one time. And this is the point now. This is the tragedy. One, he'd been in the lower realms in the past. It had run out. But he hadn't lived in vows. He hadn't purified his tendency. So he woke up in this life as a human and he got the residual results of past killing. One, the tendency to keep killing. Two, he even got the second one, experience similar to the cause. He died young. Not everybody gets that. And three, he had good environment, so he didn't have that problem. But this is the first one. So what happened is this. When he was born, this is the technology of samsara. You know, when he's born, when he went fishing, he saw fishing for the first time. It never occurred to him to kill fish because he hadn't met fishing. When he met fishing, instantaneously what that did was trigger the memory, really. You don't think of it as a memory, but why is it when we meet certain things and see certain things and meet certain people, there's like instant recognition, isn't there? A little girl sees she sees gymnastics and she right there knows that's my job. I mean, lucky me, I went to mass at the age of 3 and I fell in love with being a priest. I'm going to be a priest, I said. I knew it was my job. I announced, you know. Lucky me, I had an imprint. Instead of going to kill, I want to be a priest. Well, they wouldn't let me be a priest, of course, because I wasn't a boy, right? Anyway, whatever. I'm just saying. Whatever we're attracted to is because we've done it before. So this fisherman, this little boy, a good boy with good qualities and a good life, he meets fishing and instantaneously what happens is this feeling, pleasant feeling, pleasure, arises in his mind. And that's the strength of the pleasure that you experience on meeting an object is the strength of the karmic connection you've got with it. So clearly the karmic connection was very strong. The memory was triggered. That millisecond pleasant feelings arise. And this is the point. We all want pleasant feelings. That's all we want. So obviously he meets fishing, pleasant feelings arise. And then the next millisecond attachment kicks in and paints the most divine picture in the whole world. So of course he wants to do fishing again because that's caused happy feelings. And so what happened? He spent his life fishing. I'm not being rude to anybody. This is how karma works. So he hasn't purified the tendency. He exhausted the main result. He gets a human body. And then I'm sorry, I've got to, you know, I won't swear, but I'll spell it out. He P-I-S-S-E-S-es his life down the toilet because he doesn't know that fishing is harming sentient beings. And this is the worst tragedy. He's got attachment to it. Unbelievable attachment. He thinks of fishing all the time. This is what attachment does. He thinks about it. His whole life is defined as being a fisherman. His whole life is defined in terms of killing fish. People think it's a good activity. Don't. I'm not trying to be critical to anybody. This is how karma works. So this is the point. The worst tragedy is this. Because he's got attachment to it, it paints a very delicious picture. So fishing appears delicious to him. And every day in those boats, every day of his 29 years, maybe 25 years, he saw the fish flapping their little bodies, unable to get out of the boat, clearly, clearly suffering. But he was as blind as a bat because he saw fishing through the lenses of his own attachment. This is how attachment is like a honey-covered razor blade. And this is where we misuse each other. We confuse it with being kind. He's a kind boy. He wasn't a torturer. He was a torturer, actually. Fish die a terrible death. And the strength, the way the being is harmed when they die very much plays a role in the extent of your negative karma, you know. Now, his mummy went fishing with him one time. She didn't have a tendency to kill. She had no attachment to fishing. So guess what? She could see nakedly the truth. The fish were really unhappy. Like the little boy could see, knew the lice were suffering, and he had compassion for the lice because he didn't have a tendency to kill. He didn't have a tendency to harm because he lived in vows and he had done the purification practice. This is the tragedy of the human realm. So what happened? He died when he was 29. I met her in Koppan in the mid-90s, and she came to my room crying, having just heard Lama Zopa's teachings about karma. She was devastated. "Where has he been reborn?" she said. And I said, "I don't know, but go and ask Geshe Lama Khonchog, this amazing holy yogi who lived in Vajrayogini's Pure Land." And these lamas very, very, very rarely tell you what they see, you know. I mean, they're totally clairvoyant. But in this case, he told her. She said, "Where's he been reborn?" He said, first he was reborn in the animal realms, and now he's in the hell realms. And then she said, "Oh no, what can I do for him?" And Geshe Lama Khonchog sort of laughed sadly. And he said, "What do you mean for him?" He said, "For everybody." I met her years later. She's not a Buddhist, but this really moved her. You know, it was very fascinating. It was good for her mind to hear it. And this is shocking stuff for us. We can't bear to hear all this stuff. So then, you know, logically, the vast majority of humans are just got a human body because they've run out of their negative karma, but they haven't lived in vows. They're not conscious. They don't observe their mind. They don't purify. They have no view of karma. They have no view on cause and effect. They have no view that they're creating themselves. So they just act out. We live out. We eat up. It's like you've got a garden full of veggies because they have created good karma. Some are very rich. Some are very beautiful. They've got the good karma. It's ripening, but they just tip it down the toilet because they don't know how to create virtue from it. So what happened is they die and they go to the lower realms. This is the tragedy. So this is why we need to live in vows and purify our minds. That's the logic from Buddha's teachings. Then you can guarantee that you'll die with a happy mind, David, and happily get another human rebirth and keep on moving uninterrupted on your spiritual path, dear. It's the logic of it. It's not hit and miss. It's not cross your fingers. It's not hope for the best. It's not punishment. It's not reward. From the Buddha's point of view, it's a natural law. And it's really only, I mean, Rinpoche is just amazing in the way he stresses this. He talks about it again, and he makes it so clear. And how come I can say any of these words? It's because I've studied his teachings, you know. Not that I know that much, but but I've got enthusiasm for living in vows. I'm trying my best to live in my vows, you know. And the psychology, we're talking about psychology here, not religion. The powerful decision to do this and do this and do this. The powerful decision is what makes it happen, you know. It's your mind. And the same with purification, which we're going to do before we finish.
Venerina, just to interrupt you, we've got potentially three or potentially four more questions and about half an hour left.
No, we're fine. We'll do it. Okay, we'll do it. So anyone now, please ask me questions.
You want to do the questions, yeah?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
I'll do the practice quite short. I'm going to do the practice quite short because once you know how to do it, and I'll send you, you know, I'm going to send. Did I put it in the document? I forget. I have to look in the document. I owe it to another centre from before. But I'll look in the document and I'll double check. I think I put it in the document.
Okay. I'll just keep you in.
No, please, it's fine. But every practice in, that we're discussing here is in these teachings, are in the book. They're in the your course notes. Okay?
That's great. I'll just keep you in touch with time then. So the first question has come from Kelly. Oh, is it Kelly? Or was there somebody before? No, I think there was. Sorry, I've lost my chat.
Okay, go
sorry.
On, Kelly.
No, go sorry, on. Cassia. Sorry, Cassia before Kelly. Sorry, Cassia, okay, would you want to ask your question?
Good, darling. Talk
and then Kelly. Yeah.
Venerable Robina.
Yes, Kathy.
How to transform all activities in daily life to be virtuous?
Well, you've got to be highly realized, but you can try. So the first level is you live in vows. This is already powerful. You live in vows and you do the purification every day. That's fundamental. You've got to do that. The next level is the bodhisattva approach, where you now, by adding a powerful motivation, like bodhicitta, before you do any action. This is what Lama Zopa says, do everything with bodhicitta. What it means is you're living in your vows already. You're purifying your mind already, but you're doing all the ordinary actions of day-to-day life, eating, sleeping, going to the toilet, which seems so benign, but they're all driven by attachment. You know? They're all driven by attachment. The ones of the vows in the very beginning are vowing to stop doing the very powerful actions that harm others, at least that. But you're still doing actions like eat, sleep, go to the toilet, walk here, go there, go shopping, all the things that are driven by attachment. So we've got to purify them too. But the powerful way in the bodhisattva path to transform them is before you do it, you think, why am I going shopping? I'm going to buy nice clothes. Why? So I can look nice, so I can be a benefit to others. Right there, you put a virtuous motivation into otherwise what we an action driven completely by attachment. Look at food. It's so spontaneous. We just shove the food in the mouth mindlessly. So we're increasing attachment. The vows take care of the most heavy actions. Don't kill, don't steal, don't lie. So this is a powerful approach in the bodhisattva path to transform eating, sleeping, going to the toilet, even having sex. You've got a partner, you know, and you think before you have sex, truly with the purest motivation, I'm going to be kind and generous and loving and respectful. Meanwhile, so straight away, you put a motivation of virtue and that loosens the grip of attachment a little tiny bit, you know. So this is the skillful method. This is skillful means. And then it becomes real eventually when you'll only do things to be a benefit to others. And then finally, when you realize emptiness, the other one is see that it has no intrinsic nature. So adding bodhicitta and emptiness into everything else is what puts atomic bombs under them and loosens the grip of attachment and all the other business. Do you understand?
Yes. Yes.
But living in vows is the fundamental. And then when you get to the bodhisattva path, you live in the bodhisattva vows. And then you live go to the next level, you live in the tantric vows. Vows are basically a decision to not do something. So when you drive a car, you probably have 100 vows, but you don't think of it as a vow. You know, you decide, I will not put the foot on the accelerator at the same time as the brake. If you don't vow to do that, you'll crash in 1 minute. So we never think of it as a vow, do we? But so that's what a vow is a determination to not do this and not do that. And why? Why do you determine not to do things in the car? Because you want to become a good car driver. Why do you decide not to kill, lie, steal and practice the bodhisattva vows? Because you want to turn yourself into a Buddha. Vows are stupendous. Vows are great. Vows are powerful instructions. They're the basis. They're the infrastructure. And then you add all these other pieces on top, Cassia. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Cassia.
What next?
Kelly, would you like to ask your question?
My question was, does eating meat count as breaking your back pill? And I'm guessing the answer is that it depends on your intention.
No, much more complex than that. No, it's not the same. It's not like that at all. Okay, motivation plays a big role, like in everything you do. There's no question. I'm going to spend another 2 days just on this topic. I don't want to spoon feed, so I want to look at, just take the big picture. It's really important. Take the big picture. So first of all, it is really clear, isn't it, from the world that the meat industry is a pretty evil, it seems like a pretty shocking industry. It's destroying the planet. Forget about just killing, but it's destroying the planet in many ways. I've read this, okay? So from that perspective, from the environmental perspective, it's a really important thing to try and change the meat industry. This seems like it's reasonable. But the more precise, simple way to put it is, another way to look at it, is everything we think and do and say, yes, it's absolutely, we sow a seed in the mind. So, okay. Forget that. Not forget that, but I'll say that. Now, the other thing is this. This is my own personal comment. I always say it and I always cause lots of problems, but never mind, I'm saying it. We are so, because we're so obsessed with eating food, we're so attached to food and we're so obsessed with sex. So it seems to me, I'm just my adding little point here, I'm trying to be controversial, that we get much more upset about sexual violence than we do about regular violence. So you might, your father could beat you up every day and get bruises and black, but somehow you won't feel so guilty. But as soon as he sticks, as soon as there's sexual violence, we have panic attacks, we get stressed out, because I think it's because we've got intense attachment, because we're attached to our body, intense attachment to sex and food. So the food component, what I'm getting at here is, we're so obsessed with food. So there's so much hysteria around vegetarianism and veganism and fundamentalism and people lecturing everybody and shouting and yelling, and there's so much drama. And then because you're a vegetarian or a vegan, and I'm just always say these things, and I don't mean to be controversial, just making some food for thought. Then we think we're a saint, because we don't eat the flesh of a being that was killed. But you know, excuse me, you know, have a look at the world. Just to grow wheat, to grow rice, to grow vegetables, billions of little creatures are slaughtered and we don't even factor them in. I always tell this story. It's years ago on Facebook, I put a picture of me in Liverpool. When I went to Liverpool one time, went to this amazing cheese shop and I bought some kick-ass cheddar. Well, all these fundamentalist vegans on the website, how dare a Buddhist nun eat cheese, this kind of thing. I didn't want to be political, you know, so I just thought, I'd always wondered about, for example, how many creatures die on the road when you drive cars. So, of course, you Google it, someone's done the research, some Dutch fellow has done the research, and I forget the numbers, but it was like per number plate, just on a number plate of one car, per kilometre, per something, trillions of little creatures are slaughtered, smashed to smithereens. Now, Buddha calls them sentient beings. They've been your mother in the past. They've been a human. They've been a donkey. But we don't care about them. We just go, oh, it doesn't matter. You can't help it. That's how we say. Well, that's beyond nihilistic and beyond arrogant. But we care so much about one little, you know, one bunny rabbit that might get eaten. Don't misunderstand me. We've got a very narrow view about what is negative and what is positive, you know. So now another story I read about this Australian journalist in the Australian, not like but the BBC, but the ABC. He got so fed up with the fundamentalist vegans and vegetarians, you know, being all, please hear my point properly. I'm not trying to be political. It's because we're attached to food, you know. He was amazed. There's this wheat field. And in the off season, millions of little cute little field mice gather there. He had photos of them. He said they sing love songs to each other. Now, to grow the wheat, what are you going to do with some field mice? You slaughter the things. What do you think you're going to do? You don't take them away gently. You slaughter the field mice. Well, this fellow who complained about me on website, on the Facebook, I put this story in. Just put it in with no comment. And he commented back, oh, well, you can't help that, he said. Now, try and analyze that, please. You're in the wheat field and you're seeing them all putting this poison and destroying these millions of field mice. But excuse me, because you don't eat their body, oh, it doesn't matter. I think that's the most irrational, illogical thing I have ever heard. You hear my point, people? So eating meat is always the question we ask. We always ask about eating meat. What about wearing leather belts? What about eating veggies with the wheat for the holy vegetarians and the vegans? Probably 20% for the bulls, for the meat eaters, and then the 80% of the wheat is for the holy vegans and vegetarians. How can you think that you're being so virtuous? Excuse me. So the bigger point I'm making here is the Buddha's view is so perfect. He says the universe is full of suffering. This is the tragedy of samsara. Just by existing, we harm. Our bodies are a walking zoo. Our armpit is a zoo. Our mouth is a zoo. There are billions of real living beings being slaughtered just by our presence. That's the bigger picture. So get some humility, peace, and do everything we can in our power to do actions that don't harm others. But you can't not do any actions that don't harm others, because it's impossible. So that's why you've got to become conscious and have compassion and do whatever you can. So yes, give up meat because the universe has been destroyed. Yes, but don't just think you're so holy because you don't eat meat. That's the point I'm trying to make. It's far bigger than that. It's far more than that. And I think the basis is because we're so attached to eating. We're so obsessed with eating. No one has ever yet asked me the question, Kelly, in my 45 years of being a Buddhist, what's the karma of using a leather belt? We only ask it when it comes to eating meat because that's just the habit we've got. But it's far bigger than that. It's obvious, you know. So we think about it and we take responsibility. And that's why living in a vow not to kill, Kelly, at least you protect yourself from creating heavy negative karma of continuously killing. All you can do, and that's that a vow kind of guides you out of the chaos, you know. And then we have more and more compassion and we become more and more conscious. When you eat your bowl of wheat, you know those little bunny rabbits were slaughtered, the little field mice were slaughtered, and you have incredible compassion and you vow not to kill and not to harm. And eventually that helps you become a Buddha so you can be benefit to others. But we can't, just because we don't eat meat doesn't mean we're such a holy saint, is what I'm trying to say. It's way more than that. Now, when it does come to any action, if you, you know, you can have a whole array of scenarios. You know, you could be a vegetarian. And again, I've got to say things here, man, and don't be insulted, but I'm very blunt. You know, when you're, most vegetarians won't even eat an OXO cube. If they discover there's an OXO cube being put in the soup, they won't eat it. I find that a bit obsessive. I mean, this is my personal opinion. What is going to happen to you? You're going to die? Okay, if you do eat meat and you do die, that's a reasonable question. But I mean, it's like, excuse me, you know, interesting example, one friend of mine who was one attendant of a lama, and the person who invited them for dinner offered them meat, and the attendant said, oh, I don't eat meat. And the lama turned to the attendant and said, you eat that meat. So, you know, if I'm going to go to my grandma and she offered me as a lamb chop and I'm a vegetarian, who do I think I am? Is my opinion now. Who do I think I am to be so arrogant? Oh, I don't eat meat, grandma. Kind of shove it in your mouth, please, and say a mantra and bless the lamb chop and honor your mother, your grandmother's kindness. I think we just get too obsessive. This is my opinion, not Buddha's view. This is my view. I'm just giving you food for thought. All right. We've got to look at it more carefully in a more nuanced way. But because we're so attached, I mean, because we are so attached to meat, some of us are very attached to meat. I am attached to meat, I promise, which is why it's excellent I never eat meat. You know, you give me a meal that I like. I'll give me lamb chops, meat, liver, sausages, you know, a bull's bottom. I don't care about the veggies. I don't care about fruit. I hardly eat fruit in a year. Give me a bunch of meat, please. So, of course, it's beneficial for me to be a vegetarian, God almighty, because of my attachment. Some people can't stand eating meat. One of my sisters, who's very sick, and she has to eat a bit of fish now, she's never liked to eat meat. And I said, why not? She never thought about it. She's never a fundamentalist. Oh, all I see is a cow. I nearly burst into tears. I can see a cow, but I see food. So we've got to know our own mind, you know, and the karma we're creating. And if we can stop the meat industry overnight, well, please go and do it. So there's more to it than should I eat meat or not. Now, if you go out there, yes, and you have many of the views in our culture is it's good to have nice, you know, to kill your own chicken and eat it. We see that as an honorable thing to do. Well, no, that's called killing karma. That's killing karma, honey. Or if you sit there with a lamb chop and you go, oh, I'm so glad I didn't have to kill it, but thank you, everybody else, for killing it. That's heavy duty karma. It's whatever's in your mind. But we do everything we can to do as little harm as possible, as much as we can, as conscious as we can, you know. I mean, Lama Zopa, when he drives in the car, he had a big car, got a van, still has, I think. He's got it covered in mantras and mandalas and prayers. So all the little bugs who come along and get hit them, you know, they get a blessing, he says. So he's conscious and trying to do everything he can to help even the bugs, you know, instead of just saying, oh, it doesn't matter. That's terrible. Are we communicating, Kelly? That's probably our 30 minutes used up, but never mind.
Yeah, then
Food for thought. And that's why if you live in the vow of not killing, you're purifying your own mind. And, you know, and that's we can't get ahead without that one, because we are harming others by existing.
Venerable Rabina, about to interrupt you. We've got 15 minutes left and you've got...
I understand, darling. Are you going to sort of turn the clock off no matter what happens?
No. I'm just telling you where we are. And we've got about four potential...
I understand that. So we have to finish. So whatever you do... No, what I'm saying is, Steph, we have to get our things done. So if we're a little bit late, and if you have
that's fine. Yeah, we've got four questions, possibly five. Yeah,
ten more. Don't worry about it. Let's just take it as it comes, Steph. It's okay.
Kimberly, would you like to ask your question? Then Alina, if you would like to go after Kimberly. Yeah.
Go on.
Kimberly, yes.
Okay. Back to killing karma.
Yeah.
As you know, I suffered some severe spinal cord injuries from a car accident, didn't receive treatment for quite some time. So it was unusual. And I feel like I had an impression, and I checked with a lama over the karma that was being worked out. And it looks like...
Sorry, darling, I lost that fast bit of your sentence. What did you say, sweetheart?
I believe that I in my mind stream from a previous life, I have a memory of killing someone, stealing and killing them.
Darling, you killed millions of people, not just one. You've killed millions of people.
I only remember that one.
It doesn't matter whether you remember. The fact that you've done it is the point. Who cares if we remember? You've been a whale. One mouthful of one breakfast for one male. One whale, you open your mouth and 40 million beings go in, honey. So you've killed billions of creatures, Kimberly. Who cares if you remember? So what's the question? Being blunt. What's your question?
Oh, well, I guess that was... I just thought that was interesting that the injury was similar to the cause of death.
That's exactly right. So, yeah, so being sick, like being injured, like you did, and not getting the medicine to fix, that's the result of killing in the past. It's called the experience. It's called the, being sick.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think it through. The one called experience similar to the cause of killing is that you get killed or you die young. So you're not experiencing that one. You're experiencing the karmic result of killing, but as an environmental result where you get injured, get sick, and you can't get better. That's the environmental result of killing.
So if you have karma, like if I was hung to death, that which is what I thought it happened. In the past, if I was hung to death and then
I can't understand your words. What?
The injury that I have is very similar to someone having been hung, which they did to people back then. So it's a pretty interesting correlation.
Not to worry too much about this. Don't get too caught up in all the details. This all gets a bit sort of, I was hanged 42 years ago and now I've got... It's true. Everything does count. Everything is like that. But the real bigger learning, Kimberly, is... The bigger learning is, yes, everyone's done harm, and every experience we have called suffering is the fruit of that harm. And that by having the harm, and in your case, so fortunate with good things and care and love and kindness, you're purifying it. How amazing, how fantastic, how joyful. That's the thing to focus on.
So can we purify, my question was, can we purify the kinds of illnesses and injuries that come from a previous heavy karma, or is it better just to go through those karmas?
It's up to your courage. That's up to you. Nothing wrong with wanting to get better so you can be of use. But if you want to get better just because you want to be a happy person and be selfish, that's no benefit. So every millisecond of any millisecond of anything you experience is called suffering. Even a slight headache, even your toe hurts, you knock yourself when you wash the dishes. Every tiny moment that would you label suffering is the fruit of one of your past negative actions. So the bodhisattva attitude is great. I've just purified it. I've just finished it.
Okay.
There's no karma that can't be cleaned up, darling. But some karma is very heavy. So three people could have your accident and one of them will die and two won't. That depends on the karma of a person. You got the karma eventually to get people to help you. So you're pure, so you're healing yourself. So that's the fruit of your past virtue. The fact that you can have any moment of even being helped. That's the fruit of your past virtue.
Yeah, I'm pretty impressed by that. And I guess my other quick question was, the truth of karma and similar to the cause, I feel without doubt that that is a truth for us. And
I'm a bit confused. What do you mean by
that? I guess I'm just saying because of this experience, I really feel confident in the teachings around karma. And
You're not clairvoyant, are you? You can't see the cause in the past. So you're not that confident. You just, the theory of it makes sense to you.
Yeah, well, occasionally clairvoyant, but not often.
Okay, cool. Fine. So conclusion. Good, Kimberly, then.
So I have three sons, and they kill bugs and stuff, and sometimes they do it just to bug me, their mom.
Of course. Exactly. I understand that.
And it kills me inside because I know that that's not a joke. And I just, have any advice?
Yes, of course. Of course, if you're not going to stop them, you just say, oh, just a second, before you kill them, darling, I want to say a mantra. So you say a mantra and you blow on the bug and you walk away.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you.
Be skillful.
That's skillful. Thank you.
You don't panic. You don't freak out. You don't ever show that.
Very good.
So, before you kill it, of course you will, but they're just trying to test you. Oh, before you kill it, and then they're stuck with that. They're kind of, oh, that's embarrassing, you know? Then they're stuck with it. They've got no line. They can't hook you anymore. Oh, before you, just a second, honey. Before you kill it, just a second. And you go and you blow a mantra. You say, I want to bless it before you die, before it dies. Brilliant. And then that'll stop them in their tracks.
Brilliant.
Don't show any anger. Don't show any upset. Don't buy into their nonsense. And if they keep doing it, that's their karma. It's unfortunate and sad, and you can't help this. But do your best you can to bless the creatures before they die. Jonathan.
Good, yeah, Jonathan. I love good. That. Good wonderful. Angle.
Yes, oh, that's right.
Good parenting advice.
I know. That's right. Solid.
Good. Thanks Jonathan. Very much, Kimberly. Thank you. Alita, would you like to go next?
Hi, Ravina.
Alina, good darling.
Talk yes, to yes. Just bear with me. It's just I wanted to check a thought. We were talking about if you consider the most of the world, especially in the West, we're not Buddhists and people don't do purifications and they're not even aware of the things that we're doing this life. And then most of us will die in hospital or in situations that are out of control. Okay. Is it fair to say that most of people, the odds are that they're going to be born in lower realms? Because
that's what I mentioned several times in the teachings. Perhaps you didn't hear me. If we analyze what I'm describing now, that the particular example I used, the particular way of describing karma, how if you haven't purified by living in vows and by purifying in the past life, that's why you get a human body now, your negative karmas run out, the petrol tank of killing run out, you get a human body again. But because you haven't purified the tendency to kill, steal, lie, harm, and you haven't lived in vows, that's why you continue to do them, and that's why you'll go back to the lower realms. Exactly. That's the logic of it.
But not necessarily, I understand, but this is more just a question, like, for example, when my father died, well, I wasn't a Buddhist, and neither was him. I'm just wondering, if not necessarily then, just because in this lifetime I haven't purified, I haven't met the Dharma, not necessarily am I end up in the lower realm. Depends about the past.
I'm not mentioning the word Dharma. I'm not using that word. I'm just talking psychologically. Most people, I'm using the Buddhist view about karma, but most people have a tendency to kill. So when we look at that logically, it's because you killed before, isn't it? So why does the little boy have compassion for his lice? Because he's purified the habit to kill. So I forget whether it's called Buddhist or not. So most humans do kill. Most humans think it's okay to kill. Most humans, you know, don't have a view of karma. That's true. But most of us, we just look at our tendencies. This is the tragedy. We've got the human body, which is the fruit of virtue. But then look at the way we use this human life by killing, harming, or even if you're a nice little next door neighbor lady, you know, is the nice next door housewife next door. She seems such a nice lady. But have a look at her mind, not being rude. She just is depressed. She gets angry. She gets upset. She's not a torturer. She's not a murderer. She doesn't show like a big footprint on the planet, but she's a typical person who just follows her feelings, has no idea about impermanence, no idea about being aware, no consciousness, and then dies with a miserable mind. Of course she's going to go to the lower realms. It's not being horrible. It's logical if we look at people's minds. It's not being judgmental. It should give us unbelievable compassion. That's the point. That's why at the time of death, like when I discussed with Malcolm, forget about having a conscious decision with your grandmother about death. Do things that don't need her to be engaged in it. Like, with, of course, this is the Buddha's view, showing her statues, saying mantras to her, saying mantras while she's in a coma, blessing her mind. But of course, this is the Buddha's view. These are the one things we can't, that's what you can do with dogs, cats, mice, ants, the same. That's why these are such powerful practices, to help them at the time of death, just in case, to be able to trigger one of their virtuous karmic seeds, which wouldn't otherwise be triggered if they're left to their own resources of fear and attachment. That's why death's so precious, to help people.
Thank you, Alina. Thank you, Alina. The next person is Sandy. I don't know if you've still got your question, and then Susie. Yeah?
Talk to me, Sandy.
Sandy? Would you like to unmute yourself, Sandy, and ask your question?
Yeah, thank you. Hi.
Hello. Hello,
Sandy. Very inspiring. You've sort of answered a lot of it in Kelly's question, because it was about eating meat, and now you're breaking your vow of killing.
Yes.
And I've heard everything that you said in answer to that one, and I understand it.
Yes.
So this is a little bit different, and I've said, what about Buddhists who eat fish and meat, which someone else has killed, so they don't want the animal to suffer, but they're still eating meat and fish for sustenance.
That's not valid thinking at all. That's naive and ridiculous. And that's not just Buddhists, that's anybody. I mean, most people don't want to go and kill the fish. If they had to go and kill the fish and the cow themselves, they wouldn't eat meat. It could be so disgusting. So everybody does that. We just kind of don't think about it. We see a delicious fish on the plate. We don't see it as a sentient being. So for a person who says they're a Buddhist and doesn't kill it themselves, that's really not the issue. That's not the point. They're being completely arrogant and completely ignorant, and that's a superstition. That view is not the point.
No, but that's what I mean is, are they going to get the negative karma?
No, but I'm saying it's a complete misconception. What you're saying is what people think. Many people say, oh, I won't kill it myself, so it's okay to eat meat. That isn't the point, is what I'm trying to say. That person is being completely arrogant and ignorant, thinking that I'm off the hook because I didn't kill it. Because if you've got attachment, you're creating negative karma. If you're not even being aware that it's an animal and a sentient being that died, and you're thinking, oh, I'm off the hook, that's arrogance. This is wrong view.
Yeah, I understand that. But if you're not thinking, it doesn't matter. If you're eating aware that it was an animal and you're feeling compassion for it, but you eat it anyway.
But everybody does that. So whether you're a Buddhist or not, this is how most of us are. So this is why every action is dependent on each individual, what they bring to that action. So you can have one person, let's say, once I understand your question, darling, I really do. So one person, for example, can have compassion for sentient beings, but eat meat occasionally. And they eat the meat, they think about it, they say a mantra, they blow on the flesh, they are aware of as a sentient being, they have compassion, but they eat because they need to be healthy. How can you say that person creates negative karma? Because it's just a one every occasional. Another person might have I know a man who owns a fishing company. He's now retired, and he lives off the millions of dollars coming from the killing of millions of shrimp. But he's so naive in his own mind. He says, oh, I'm not killing them, but I'm a vegetarian, he says. Now, that's insanity. How can you think of a guy who lives off the death of billions of beings but pretends but thinks he's not harming by being a vegetarian? That's completely wrong view. There can only be negativity there, because he's harming his own business, kills millions, if not billions, of shrimps. So there's just that's a bizarre kind of concept, isn't it? Then you've got another person, let's say, who's a total vegetarian but goes to their grandmother's, and she happily eats the lamb chop. So there's a million scenarios. You've got to look at each person, each time, the motivation, the scenario, what happened, how it happened, why you're doing it. It's not just a blanket thing, eat meat or don't. So it's too new, it's more nuanced. So all the time, no matter what we do, we should be conscious.
Yeah,
as much as you possibly can. Now, in general, they say the closer you are to the killing, the heavier the karma. So if I ask you to kill the fish for me, I go, I don't want to look, but I'll eat it. Then it's heavy karma for me. But if the fish has been sitting there for 1 month in the freezer, and then I eat a piece of it with compassion, how can that be negative karma? So every scenario is different, each person. And all we can do is be conscious. All we can do is be aware. So the same with wearing your leather shoes, the same with wearing your woolly cardigan, the lamb mutton didn't die, the same with all the things we use. Look at the little eggs. Look at how the millions of those little male chicks are slaughtered. They're put into this machine where they're smashed into smithereens because little male chicks are useless. So there's no matter where you turn, especially industrialized killing, you know, there's going to be so much heavy karma done. We've got to be conscious and be aware as much as we can. Now, the other bizarre thing in our culture, we think, oh, I'm eating good meat. That pig was kept happy while it was living in there, was given good food, and we think we're more virtuous. That's evil. That's worse. Why am I feeding the pig nicely so I can get a nice fresh pig at the end of it? That's like Hitler keeping people happy and healthy so they can use them for experiments and then kill them. I mean, it's like hideous. We've got these really wrong views in our minds, you know. There's many things.
I agree with you.
I know you do. I'm just trying to answer a few different things all at once.
Yeah. I agree with, you know, with.
We do what we can to be as little harm as we can to sentient beings. Given that we can't stop harming, we become as conscious as we can. We live in vows. And if we do eat meat, say a mantra. I mean, you know, if you do eat meat out of compassion, even. So Lama Zopa said one time, even a bone that's 1,000 years old, because of the karmic connection between the being whose body that was and wherever that being is now, and the power of mantra, by saying mantra, you blow on that bone, the consciousness, wherever it is now, will get the benefit. So there's always something we can do to mitigate, but we have to be conscious. But the tendency we have is we want to get off the hook. Oh, I'm doing this, therefore I'm not creating negative karma. It's too absolute, it's too blunt, it's too naive. It's much more nuanced and more subtle than that, is the broader point
I'm trying to make. I agree with you.
Yeah, but the people who say I'm a Buddhist and I didn't kill, so it doesn't matter, that's bizarre. Complete wrong view, Sandy. I agree.
But I was just thinking about how they could actually purify what they're doing if they're in that situation, like you said about the granddaughter who was eating the lamb chop.
But there's she didn't create any non-virtue.
Okay,
how did she? How did she create non-virtue? Her mind was compassionate. Her intention was to eat the meat for the grandma's sake, and she's compassionate. Just the fact that she ate a piece of dead flesh is not in itself a negative action, Sandy.
Right. Thank you.
You see my point? Yeah. I mean, eating a bowl of rice that came from the field where the field mice were slaughtered with an arrogance of it doesn't matter is far heavier karma.
Yeah, absolutely. It is.
So the eating of a piece of flesh itself is not a negative action. It's all the other things that we put together. Yeah. But we're so obsessed with eating, not you, in the world, we think eating the flesh is negative. No, it doesn't follow.
Okay, thank you for that. And if you're buying organic because you don't, you know, you believe that the pesticides and the herbicides are bad, and they're going to kill the insects and all of that, then you're being mindful, aren't you?
But the trouble is eating organic meat is that one that's so, is if there's some more virtue in that. The pig was not fed polluted food. And okay, it wasn't harmed. On your nice little chicken that lives out in the field and is not harmed while it's alive, it's still killed at the end. And what's the reason? So people will buy your nice organic meat. So it's pretty monstrous, really. We think it like that. There's many things to look at, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks very
much.
The other interesting point that I find, another point, Sandy, too, that's interesting, that we never factor in our culture. One of the commonest things we think is, it's all to do with demand. So the logic is, if we stop demanding meat, then they'll stop killing chickens. It's not like that. What we're not factoring in, one, is the karma of the creatures, of the sentient beings who've created the course to be born as a lobster or a chicken or a cow. And two, we're not factoring in the karma of people who have the karma to do a job called killing. So if you get a job in a slaughterhouse because you've got the karma to kill, you know, then if that slaughterhouse closes down, you'll go get another job where you can kill chickens because you've got the karma to kill. So we don't factor those in. So I find it very interesting. There's one example in Maine years ago in the States where the lobster place, it's a lobster city, a lobster town, a lobster state. So one year, for some no logical reason for as far as anybody else is concerned, 10 times more lobsters turned up in the waters of Maine. Well, initially, of course, the fishermen were so happy, but of course it deflated the price. Everybody got poor, and the poor Maine state government had to spend millions of dollars marketing these damn lobsters. So who ordered the lobsters? Honey, nobody. Suddenly, lots of beings had the karma to be born a lobster. So it's more than just demand, you know, it's much more nuanced than that. So if we can control industries by stopping eating meat and stop the world from being destroyed, fantastic. But on another level, it's individual karma, what you think in your mind, you know, that's the karma you create. And there's so many superstitious views we have about it. So in the end, we're probably creating even more negative karma. I mean, people who eat vegetarian for healthy reasons, that's completely samsaric. It's completely attachment. There's no virtue in that. So it's all a question of what your mind is doing, you know, and of course also the conditions, but the mind is the key thing. There's many facts to think about, people, when it comes to food. Mm. We're so neurotic about food. That's our problem.
Mm. And we have to eat food to survive. So we're not,
because we're not the greatest yogis who can live on the air. That's the trouble.
Like, that's right.
He lived on the air. You know, he was very.
No, I wish we could.
Exactly. I know. That's why, given that we have to eat, have as much compassion as we can, do as little harm as we can, do the best we can, you know. All we can do is that. We can do is that, darling.
Thank you.
So now I think we should do the purification.
Thank you very much, Sandy. We've got Susie has got a question. Rina, are you okay with that?
Okay, absolutely.
I can save it if you're in a rush. It's
not in a rush, go.
Okay, thank you, Venerable. So this is a quick question about ashes. So brilliantly, there's still a lot of dead relatives in mine and Jamie's family hovering around in ashes form. And I can't take
bulk blessing. You can do a bulk blessing, yeah.
But I can't, my question, my specific question, and I know I sound very forensic, but I want to be really clear with how to handle this. I can't just pinch all of the ashes. So I want to decant some of them because I can convince family members that I can pinch some
of
them.
All you need is a tiny bit of ashes of each one is enough.
So my slightly pernickety question, and sorry to be ridiculous, but I want to be clear. Can I just put them into a clear container? I don't have to put it into a special, I can't remember what the word was.
It doesn't matter. Put all the ashes together, mix Fred's with Mary's and Joe's, doesn't matter. A little bit of each and get junghwa done on them and then make them into satsas. Fantastic.
Great. Thank you.
Good job.
Thanks, Susie. And I just want to check with Elisa. Elisa, you did have your hand up a little bit earlier. It's gone again. Did you want to ask a question or are you okay?
No, my question is already answered. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Elisa. Okay, that's it, Venerable Rabina, with the questions.
It can be short. It doesn't have to be long. Once you get the hang of it and it's in your course notes, then you can do it yourself. Is to understand how we create karma and how we purify karma. But before we do the practice, I have to talk about how we purify karma. I will explain the technicalities of it. Okay. So what we're talking is the mind. What we're talking is psychology. So given that every millisecond of what we think and do and say, you know, sow seeds in our mind. Every millisecond of what we think and do and say that's driven by a delusion ripens as suffering. Every millisecond of what we think and do and say driven by a virtue ripens as happiness. That's the general principle. So given that we don't want suffering, we do want happiness. The first level of practice, as I said, is to stop killing, to stop doing the heaviest negative actions. Why stop doing the heaviest negative actions? Why did Buddha say don't eat too many pieces of cake? Because cake doesn't care if you sub it in. Humans do. So the heaviest negative actions are necessarily the ones that harm others. And this is the point. They are the ones that bring the heaviest negative results. They're the ones that bring in lower realms. They're the ones that bring being killed. They're the ones that bring being lied to. They're the ones that bring being harmed. That's why we stop doing those first. Then we get to the next level of practice and we start to give up the delusions themselves, give up attachment, give up anger, give up the neuroses, which are the ones that inform the action. So first you work on the servants of the body and speech, then you work on the mind. Then you add virtue to it by going to the bodhisattva path. It's a progression. So first you live in the vows. Then you purify at the end of the day. As Lama Zopa says, we are insane not to do this practice every day. So already living in vows, you're putting atomic bombs. You're stopping. Okay, with a vow, you've decided, I will not grow another weed. You stop sowing weeds in your garden. Purification is putting atomic bombs under the weeds you've already planted that haven't yet ripened. So you're taking both ends of it. One, you're not sowing more negative seeds. And two, you're purifying the past negative seeds and you're catching them before they ripen as weeds. This is the point about purification. Both practices of living in vows and purification have the function of creating bucket loads of merit, not just not doing negative actions, not just purifying the habits, but putting bucket loads of virtuous seeds in your mind as well. They're both very powerful in that way. So purification is basically four steps, the four R's. Good way to remember it, the four R's. One is, and there's a different order, but this order I like a lot. It's the analogy the lamas use, which is, it's the analogy of having eaten poison. So if you've eaten poison, you know the meaning of poison. That instant, you'll be galvanized into action. Oh my God, I can't believe I've eaten poison. Quick, what will I do about it? That's the attitude. Now, our problem is we are riddled with guilt. We are convinced we did a bad action, I'm a naughty person, and I'll get punished. And we get paralyzed by this guilt. This is totally useless, totally irrational. And it's the view that we have. We think of bad actions like that. So as soon as we hear Jesus or mummy or grandma or Buddha say, don't do that, we immediately feel guilty and we think we mustn't get caught. And if we get caught, we're going to get punished. That's the dualistic view of punishment and reward. And that's not what's involved here. Buddha is not a punisher. He is not a rewarder. He is not a boss. He is not a creator. Just like your doctor says, don't smoke. Why not, doctor? Because you'll get cancer, baby. You'll be grateful for her advice. But instead of hearing it as, you mean you're going to punish me with cancer? People would laugh at you if you thought that. But that's how we think. It's our dualistic view, very deep. So we've got to look at this so carefully. So this first step is regret. It's not guilt. And even if we do spell it out now, we're still going to misunderstand it. A commonest thing we feel is when we say, I regret killing. Oh, I killed, you know, I killed the ants today. And then we say, I regret having killed. What we think it means is either, oh, I killed the ants, conclusion, I'm a bad person. That's guilt, useless. Or we think, I killed the ants, I shouldn't have killed the ants. That's anger. When your mother says you shouldn't have done that, that's a totally useless thing to say. It doesn't solve anything. So if you've taken poison, you just don't say to yourself, oh, I'm a bad person. I ate poison and you keep getting sicker every day. I'm a bad person. That's how we are. We're insane. We drown in guilt. It's the most useless state of mind. And guilt is anger, but you're the object. We love guilt. It's our favorite thing. We run to it. It's ego's function. So anger is, you point to another person. You did this and you did that and you did this and you're a bad person. Well, that's exactly what guilt is, except you're pointing to yourself. And we run to this automatically. So we've got to consciously change it. Consciously change it. When we think, I regret killing, I regret stealing, I regret that abortion when I was 23. I regret those things. And then you've got to ask, why am I regretting them? Because I know when I did those actions out of ignorance, I didn't mean to do it. Out of ignorance, I ate that poison. I didn't know it was poison. Out of ignorance, now I've discovered I sowed a negative seed in my mind. So I regret having done that because I don't want the future suffering. I don't want the future suffering. So this is renunciation. This is the crucial thing. And we miss this completely, especially in the West. We hear it wrongly. We hear it as guilt. We hear it as I'm a bad person. When we hear it as punishment. It's completely nonsense. It's like you've eaten poison. You know immediately you don't want the suffering it will bring. So you're galvanized into action to go to the next point, which is, where's the doctor? Whom can I turn to give me the medicine to purify it? And you purify it. You rely upon the doctor. So the second step is reliance. So when you do the first one, regret, in the end of the day, you can just check what you've done that day. You know, you badmouth your boyfriend, you kick the dog, you did this, you did that. And you think of it as eating poison, but you've harmed yourself. This is the key point about the first stages of practice and karma. You're harming yourself. It's like compassion for yourself. If you hear it this way, it transforms the process, you know. It's self-respect. So you think of the things you have done. And then, of course, there's a million other actions that you don't remember doing, but they were done out of ignorance when you did them. So they've sowed the seed, whether you like it or not. In other words, when you start to see yourself getting, you know, sick because you've eaten too much chocolate, you don't have to remember which piece of chocolate each minute. You just know the general principle. Too much chocolate, babe. Learn from it, you know. You regret it because I don't want the future suffering. So this brings you naturally to the next step. What can I do about it? But the other point about regret, you do today's actions, then you think of all the things you must have done in this life that you don't remember that have harmed sentient beings. You've broken your vows, all those things, as well as harming sentient beings. And then you can think, and whatever I've done since beginningless time with my body and speech to harm any sentient beings, is the point, you know, to Kimberly, the billions of lives I've had as a whale, especially as animals. Spirits harm others, but they're so caught up in their own suffering. And hell beings just completely suffer. They don't harm anybody. They're just living in hell, living a nightmare of suffering, mental suffering. But animals are the worst, heaviest rebirth for harming, because they're so driven by ignorance and fear, so driven by attachment and aversion and aggression, and their karma is to be together, just eat and being eaten. It's like an absolute nightmarish life. So they do the heaviest harm. So you think of all the lives that have been an animal, every action I've ever done to harm sentient beings, I regret from the depths of my heart, because I do not want those karmic seeds to ripen as my suffering. Because you know what, Rabina, you talk to yourself, I am sick of suffering. That's the point about regret. You've got to make it sound like that. Compassion for yourself. So then, of course, whom can I turn to? Where's the doctor? So the ideal way to do this practice, and all the lamas teach it this way in all the traditions, well, you do it in the context of visualizing the Buddha from Tantra called Vajrasattva. It's the practice that's most praised by all the lamas. So the next step, whom can I turn to? Reliance. And there's two parts. The first part is you visualize, you know, Vajrasattva above your crown, who's the Bodhisattva style, the aspect of Buddha in Tantra, is the white aspect of Vajradhara, the main tantric Buddha. And he's your lama, and he's above your crown, holding a Dordian bell, radiant white light body. And basically, here is the reliance part. Is now you, it's like you're delighting that you found a doctor, the Buddha. So, you know, you can say a little prayer of refuge there, but in your heart, feel so delighted that you found a doctor whose methods you can use to purify yourself. This is the second step. The first part of the second step. The second part of the second step is under the reliance, is now where you have compassion for others whom you have harmed. The first one's compassion for yourself. So now you think of those you've harmed. And why they call it reliance is because without having suffering people, you can't have compassion. So you need to remember suffering people, rely upon in that sense. So you now think about those you've harmed. The dog, the cat, the ex-boyfriend, the baby you aborted, and you have compassion for them. They don't want suffering either. And you wish to purify for their sake. The first is for your own sake. Don't just skip over that. Then also here, if you're brave enough, you can have compassion for those who've harmed you. And why would you do that? Because they are going to suffer terribly in the future as a result of their harming you. So they're the real object of real compassion. As Geshe Sopa said, the bodhisattvas need their enemies. Best object of compassion, if you can. If you're not ready to forgive the person who's harmed you, then don't go there. But have compassion for those you have harmed. Third step, the remedy. You do the practice. So here, you're visualizing Vajrasattva. And we'll do it when we do the practice very briefly. And you're doing two things. You're visualizing certain things by purifying. You imagine purifying, and you're reciting the mantra. That's the remedy. And the fourth one is resolve. Pavongka Rinpoche says it's the most important. You make a decision to change. So this is a psychological process, I tell you. Don't think of it as religion. You are deciding. You, and as Lama Yeshe says, what purification is the power of regret, the power of reliance, the power of the remedy, the power of the resolve to change. Your mind, as Lama Yeshe says, creates negativity, and so you purify it with your mind by creating positivity. And there's no karma that can't be purified. So this puts atomic bombs under the tendencies and prevents us from doing them in the future. So by the time you live in vows and do purification, so I said to David, you have got the perfect practice. You bring in the Buddha, you try to add compassion to it, all the future bits, but this is the fundamental, this is the basis, this is the ground work of practice. So let's just do it briefly. Just be very casual, be very relaxed about it, okay? So we regret. So just think yourself today, this life, certain actions that you have done out of your ignorance. Don't try to get yourself off the hook. You did do them because it's your habit. Just own it. You did it. You know, but because you're ignorant, because you're foolish, because you didn't realize, because the habit was there from past karma. You just followed your feelings. So you just acknowledge some of the things you've done, harming sentient beings with your body and speech. And just say them to yourself and think, well, you know, you talk to yourself, Rubina, I regret having done that because I don't want the future suffering. So just think of some things yourself. Things you've done with your body and speech to harm others. Think of those actions. You know, the killing, the abortion, maybe the animals, the creatures we've killed, our little pet, even that one, our little pet we meant so well, you know, we didn't create much negative karma, but we were foolish. Compassion's not enough, His Holiness says, you need wisdom. So you'd be sad you didn't have the wisdom to be certain that killing your pussycat at that time would guarantee your pussycat would get a human birth. We couldn't guarantee. So out of foolishness, even though your motivation was pure, you regret the killing of the cats, the rats, the cockroaches, the baby. The lying, the stealing, keeping the things that someone gave you didn't return. Then the speech, this is our favorite, bad-mouthing people, criticizing, harsh speech, lying, all these actions, we've all done them. Join the universe, folks. And we think, I regret this. Talk to yourself. You know what? I'm sick of suffering. I don't want to keep these habits. I don't want to keep doing them. And I do not want them to happen to me. No way. Not to mention lower realms. I'm sick of suffering. I'm sick of suffering. And now if you can, it makes sense. All the things you've done since the beginning of this time in all these countless past lives, trillions of lifetimes, the karmic seeds of which are in the mind that haven't yet ripened. So we want to put this atomic bomb under them before they ripen. So of course we do this. We regret from the depths of our hearts all the dumb actions we must have done in past lives. Because I don't want the future suffering. You know, I am sick of suffering. Then we can think of all the crazy delusions, the depression and the anger and the resentment and the attachment and the nonsense. Of course you regret this. You're sick of suffering. My laziness, you know, can't be bothered. Regret this because we're harming ourselves. And if we've lived in vows and have not kept our vows properly, we just got a bit lazy, you know. Broken our samaya, our word of honor, if we've taken practices, and certainly in past lives we've done this. So we regret from the depths of our heart, our broken practice, spiritual practice, our broken vows, because we are the recipient of the suffering. It's not guilt, it's kindness to ourselves. I'm sick of suffering. I want to keep connected with the spiritual path. I want to keep connected with the Buddha. I want to break all my, you know, purify all my broken samaya. I'm sick of suffering. So then we think, whom can I turn to? Who's my doctor? So here's the Buddha, you know, above your head, in the Bodhisattva style, Vajrasattva, radiant white light body, so beautiful. Your Lama, if you have a Lama, manifesting as Vajrasattva for your benefit. So radiant, so blissful. So now you visualize, and we just delight that we've got this doctor. Being delighted, you've got a doctor. Be delighted you found the Buddha. What a miracle. Who's got methods that we can use to purify ourselves. We do the purification, not Buddha. We just use him. The second part is we have compassion now. Now we have compassion for those we've harmed, the rats, the cockroaches, the baby, the pussycat, all the beings we've harmed. Since beginningless time, all the sentient beings we've harmed. Since beginningless time, the trillions of sentient beings, I must purify for their sake. Of such compassion. So now we do the third step. So visual, Lama Chanrezig so happily, you know. Sorry, Lama Bodhisattva, so delighted. What he does first is sends this very powerful hose, like a hose of nectar, very, very powerful, like those very powerful hoses, like white nectar that arcs around from his heart, that arcs around and enters our crown, okay? Imagine this. And it forcefully pushes out to the lower parts of our body all the imprints of all the harm we've ever done since beginning this time with our bodies, like filthy liquid. Imagine this. When you're using your creative imagination, that's what visualization is. And it's your mind. So the more strongly you want to purify, the more you feel you're purifying is what purification is. Your mind created negativity. So now we're counteracting it by creating positivity. The strength of your mind is what does it. There's no negativity that's inherent. It's not intrinsic. So you imagine, as we say the mantra, just 3 times. And if you don't know it, just hear it. Doesn't matter. If you don't know the long one, you say the short one. Om Vajrasattva Hum. Om Vajrasattva Hum. Just repeat that if you don't know the long one. If you know the long one, say it with me. Otherwise, just keep repeating the short one. Om Vajrasattva Hum. As we see this nectar forcing down from Lama Vajrasattva, forcing through our crown, entering into us like a hose of energy, washing us out. And all the imprints of all the harm we've ever done with our bodies, disappearing into space like filthy liquid. Nothing left. How marvelous. Think like this. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manu Padaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Me Bhava Suto Shayo Me Bhava Supo Shayo Me Bhava Anurato Me Bhava Sarva Siddhi Me Prayatsa Sava Karma Sutsa Me Sitam Triyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mutsa Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ha Hung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manu Padaya Vajrasattva Cheno Patita Jiro Mebawa Suto Shayo Mebawa Supo Shayo Mebawa Anuratto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sava Karma Sutsa Me Sitam Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mutsa Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manu Padaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Jiro Mebawa Surashayo Mebawa Suposhayo Mebawa Anurakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sava Kama Sutsa Me Siddham Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramami Mutsa Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ha Hung Pe Disappeared into space on one atom left, imagine, full of this blissful nectar. All the imprints of all the karmic actions we've ever done since beginning this time with our bodies, gone. Full of this blissful nectar. How amazing. And now Vajrasattva is so compassionate, Lama Vajrasattva. What he does this time, sends the nectar again, arcs around, forcefully enters our crown, fills us completely. But this time, it comes all to the surface and it drives out upwards all the imprints of all the harm we've ever done with our speech, which of course is us clever humans, lying, bad-mouthing, harsh speech, you know, gossiping, rabbiting on about nothing. All this negative imprints forced upwards like filthy liquid disappearing through the top parts of our body into space. Just like as Lama Yeshe says, when you turn on a tap in the sink, all the junk in the glass comes to the surface. Imagine that. Use your creative imagination. Delightedly, happily, rid of all this rubbish. As this nectar forcefully comes like a hose of energy from Lama Vajrasattva into us, as you say the mantra. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manu Palaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Jiro Mebawa Suto Shayo Mebawa Supo Shayo Mebawa Anuratta Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Meprayatsa Sava Kama Sutsa Me Sitam Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramami Mutsa Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupadaya Vajrasattva Chenopajita Dido Mebawa Sutoshaya Mebawa Suposhaya Mebawa Norakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Mebrayasa Sava Karma Sutsame Siddham Shriyam Kuru Hong Ha 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 Ho Bhagawan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramame Mutsa Vajraba Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupadaya Vajrasattva Chenopajita Dido Mebawa Sutoshaya Mebawa Subhashaya Mebawa Anoracha Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Mebrayasa Sava Kama Sutsame Siddham Shriyam Kuru Hong Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramame Mutsa Vajraba Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe. Full of this blissful nectar, all the negativity of speech gone. How marvelous. So now, Lama Vajrasattva so compassionately sends, this time beams of light. And I always say this, I don't know if beams of light can bend, but we have to pretend they do. These laser beams of white light from his heart that arc around and enter our crown. And this time, instantly it hits us. Instantly, the negativity is dispelled, isn't it? Instantly. Lama Yeshe says, as soon as you turn on a light in the room, instantly the darkness is dispelled. Same here with all the delusions and why they can be dispelled. And this is Buddha's logic, because they don't have no basis in reality. They're made up rubbish, these delusions. They're not valid. They have no basis in reality. They're made up nonsense. So they can be disappeared. They can be annihilated. How amazing. So as we say the mantra three times, this light filling us with bliss. All the delusions gone. How incredible. Think like this. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Chenopajita Dito Mebawa Sudoshaya Mebawa Suposhaya Mebawa Anuracha Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Mimprayatsa Sava Kama Sutsame Siddham Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mutsa Vajraba Mahasama Sattva Ahung Pe. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Chenopajita Dito Mebawa Sudoshaya Mebawa Suposhaya Mebawa Anuracha Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Mimprayasa Sava Kama Sutsame Siddham Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mutsa Vajraba Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Chenopajita Dito Mebawa Sudoshaya Mebawa Suposhaya Mebawa Anuracha Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Mimprayasa Sava Kama Sutsame Siddham Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mutsa Vajraba Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe. All delusions gone. How amazing. Liberation. Ignorance gone. Attachment gone. Anger gone. Fear's gone. Jealousy gone. Unbelievable. So now there's one more to do. I call this like a second rinse. We've now achieved liberation. Now we're going to achieve omniscience. So they call this removing even the subtlest imprints to all the delusions. And it sounds a bit busy, but we'll do it like the lamas teach it. You do the three together. I don't know whether you do them consecutively or together. I don't know. I never quite know how to do it. So I do it in a different way, but I'll do it the way the lamas say. So all the light going down, all the nectar going down, all the nectar going up, and all the light coming, removing even the subtlest imprints of these actions, which means we achieve omniscience. We become a Buddha. And all our virtues are manifest. All the infinite love, infinite wisdom, infinite compassion, infinite goodness, which are our true nature. Visualize this. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Chenopajita Dito Mebawa Sudoshaya Mebawa Suposhaya Mebawa Anuracha Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Mebrayatsa Sava Kama Sutsame Siddham Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mutsa Vajraba Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Chenopajita Dito Mebawa Sudoshaya Mebawa Suposhaya Mebawa Anuracha Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Mebrayasa Sava Kama Sutsame Siddham Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mutsa Vajraba Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe. Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Chenopajita Dito Mebawa Sudoshaya Mebawa Suposhaya Mebawa Anuracha Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Mebrayasa Sava Kama Sutsame Siddham Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mutsa Vajraba Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe. now the fourth step, Lama Vajra suffers so happily. No, not quite yet. Sorry, we missed a bit. The fourth step. Now the fourth and most important Mahavongra Rinpoche says, determination to change. This is where the consonants. You know, if we can't do regret, if we can't own responsibility for the things that we did, we try to get off the hook and blame other people and feel guilty, then you can't go further. You can't do any of the further steps. So regret is the opening, the door to it. You own it. Then you purify because you're sick of suffering and you purify for compassion. Then you make decisions to change. It's your mind decides. When your mind decides to do something, you will do it. So if we can just say, even here now, we can reiterate our vows. I say our loud vows. I will do everything I can not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, not to this, not to that. You keep digging the groove deeper in your mind. You make it conscious. You reiterate your vows. How marvelous, you know. So then you don't lie to yourself. Like some of us have got bodhisattva vows and tantric vows, and there's so many. And it's impossible to keep them all. You'd be a Buddha already. So you have to be very sincere with ourselves. Well, I'll do my best to do this one and watch myself like a hawk with this one. But if you haven't taken all the vows and you say, you know, maybe you don't lie to yourself and say you never badmouth your boyfriend again. Well, I won't badmouth him for 24 hours. I will really not say one word to my mother for 5 minutes. You make a strong decision, and that decision is what guides you to do exactly that. We are the boss. We just got to feel like the boss, that's all. So make some decisions to yourself, what you plan to do. I will do this. I will not do that. I will do this for 5 minutes, for 1 hour. I will do the best to keep my vows, whatever you want to say to yourself. I'll try not to be jealous for 5 minutes. I'll try not to get angry for 3 minutes. Whatever you feel, your own rubbish habits, talk to yourself. You're talking to yourself here. Buddha's like your witness, but you're the boss here. You're talking to yourself. You're giving yourself courage. So then Lama Vajrasattva very happily dissolves into white light and comes through our crown, and we think the energy of the body, speech and mind of the Buddha, the body, speech and mind of our Lama merge with our body, speech, mind. Just sit there for a minute, blissing out. Feel very happy. No thoughts. Okay, we're done. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Steph.
Thank you so much, Venerable Ravina, yes. Would you like the dedication prayers shared? Yes.
Sure thing. Let's do
it. Okay.
So we're just thinking of the meaning again. Just think of the meaning. We'll say it in English first. I'll say the words, and we do the Tibetan. Just thinking the meaning of this. Here we've been how many days? Feels like about 6 weeks, doesn't it? All together, all these hours we've been together, as many thoughts as we've had, is as many seeds we've planted. We should be over the moon with delight with ourselves and each other that we've sown all these amazing seeds, you know. And so we're thinking that, you know, that in order to become a Buddha, what's this? Very strange. What's this mean? Oh, I see. Okay, so we think as a result of all these karmic seeds we planted, which won't go astray, so we're going to nourish them, may I quickly become a Guru Buddha, a Buddha, you know, a Buddha, the same as our Lama. And then I'm able to lead every single suffering sentient being, without exception, to that very state. We're thinking this way. Kewa din yudu dag, lama sangye drubgyo ne, drowa chikyang malupa deyisala gurpa shok. and this wonderful one of the aspiration about bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is this amazing attitude that's as a result of compassion, not compassion, it's a result of compassion, where now the only thing that occurs to you is to help others and never giving up long-term on becoming a Buddha, because then you're perfectly qualified. So may this precious supreme bodhicitta, not yet born in the minds of beings, may it arise, not yet born, may it arise. And if it has arisen in the minds of others, may it not decline, but increase more and more. Jam chob sem chog rinpoche, ma kye panam kye gyu chig, kye panyam pa me pa yi, gong ne gong du, pava chog. So we think, yeah, how wonderful. We do the second one, Lama's Opus. We'll do the second one, Rinpoche's. That's it, the second one. That's it. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, the incomparably kind, supreme Tenzin Gyatso, may your life be long and your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjuna's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplishes magnificent prayers, honoring the three jewels, the three sublime ones, savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And all any of our lamas, all our lamas, all our teachers, may they live long. The world needs them badly, you know. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you so much, Rabina. We'd just like to finish, if it's okay with you, to offer a mandala dedicating the merits of listening to the teachings, followed by your long life prayer. So I'm just going to share the merits of listening.
Wonderful, yes. So here, we just say the words, you know, may whatever we say together, we think of the, oh, this is another dedication, the merits of listening. Okay, may whatever virtue I've collected benefit the teachings and all transmigratory beings, and in particular, may it cause the essence of perfect, pure Lozang Dakpa's teachings to shine forever. So now that's the one you're talking about.
That's
perfect. That's wonderful. Okay,
good. You've done it. Edam Guru Ratnarit.
But then that's dedicating the merits of listening. That's not the mantra. The next one's the mantra, but it's the long one.
Do you want to do the short one?
Yeah, at the end, we're going to do the short one. That's the mantra as a thank you.
Sorry, I've gone too far.
That's okay, darling. Would have been at the end there. Of the long one. So go one up again. This is the one. Here it is, here, exactly. This is the short mantra. As a thank you, we're thanking the Buddha for all the teachings. Saji Perki Jogshing Metog. You should be doing it. You lead it. You're thanking for the teachings. Go on.
Saji Perki Jogshing Metog.
Oh,
And then, Faye, would you like to share the screen so that we can recite together Venerable Robina's long life prayer? Thank you. So, Mother of the Victorious Ones of the Three Times and Ten Directions, Dharmakaya, the great bliss embraced by great compassion, my perfect Aryatara, who in an ordinary form are the guide for us pitiful transmigratory beings left guideless, how kind you are. May all your wishes be instantly fulfilled, and may your life be stable until samsara ends. O mighty one, you who destroy all the enemy of delusions, who reveal the Dharma of scripture and realization, spreading it in the mental continuum of transmigratory beings, thereby eliminating the two obscurations, including their imprints, how kind you are. May all your wishes be instantly fulfilled, and may your life be stable until samsara ends. By the blessings of the Guru, the deity, and the Dharma protectors, and unbetraying actions and their results, as well as the truth of ultimate reality, in all my lifetimes may I only please and never displease for even one second the Guru, and may all the vital points of my prayers be fulfilled. Thank you so much, Venerable Robina, for your incredible teachings. And I'm just going to hand over to Jenny now to bring it all to end.
Thank you, Steph, darling. Thank you so much.
Thank you.